If your lifetime revenue is four times your customer acquisition cost, you've got a pretty great head start to try to trickle that money down to make money at the bottom of the income statement. But if you're at 2-to-1, then more and more components of the income statement start to matter in order to allow that double on revenue that you're getting on the customer acquisition to trickle through to make profit.
And welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features, but I'm not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Sal Tirabassi from CFOPros.com, part of my continuing series of fractional CFOs I'm talking to. And Sal has started his business comparatively recently, but has marked himself out by having what would most would consider be an explosive start out of the gates here, gathering clients. So we're going to talk about how he managed to launch that firm so successfully, so quickly. We're also going to talk about operationalizing finance advice. So it's all very well to have the plan in a spreadsheet somewhere, but then where the rubber really hits the road is getting those plans into action. And we're going to focus on managing sales teams in particular today. So Sal, thanks very much for coming along to the Growth Profit Podcast. Just maybe tell us, where are you in the world today?
Hey, thank you for having me. This is going to be a lot of fun, so I'm looking forward to it. So I'm based in the New York City area. I run a CFO services business. And prior to running my own CFO services practice, I was a professional CFO for about 9 years, building a business from about 80 employees to about 1,000. And prior to that, I was a growth equity and private equity investor, kind of like in the zone of sort of later stage venture capital, kind of lower middle market buyouts. I did that for 15 years as a partner in 2 funds. Mm-hmm. And my previous experience was in management consulting. And, you know, that whole arc of starting out as a management consulting, learning a ton about running businesses and investing in companies, buying and selling assets in private equity really informed, you know, how I do my CFO services practice and mm-hmm. try to really add value to businesses that are in that $3 to $100 million range. A lot of my clients are bootstrapped entrepreneurs who have gotten to 10, 30, 50, 60 million of revenue on their own. And they sort of wake up one day and they realize, wow, I'd really like to have an idea of what the next 90 days is going to look like. And then, you know, once you start talking to them, you realize, well, you know, it's not just the next 90 days, it's the next 360 days. And they all of a sudden open up with capital raising issues, management of the business, and they need all these kinds of insights. And they realize that, you know, the one or two accountants that they have on the team aren't really trained in doing strategic finance. And right. That's where I kind of step in with my team and really help bridge that gap.
So when you say bootstrap entrepreneurs, when I think bootstrap, I think people who haven't raised finance. So do you work with people who are transitioning from that to a, sort of a funded model? And what's the motivation there? If you're doing 50 or 60 million bootstrapped, I imagine, I don't know, tell me if I'm wrong, life is pretty good. So why would you want to go and get the bankers involved?
You know, they're usually thinking about growing faster. Sometimes they realize that they could also just bring some leverage into the business. And so it's not just always equity-based financing that they're thinking about. It's also, you know, can they go and get some sort of, not necessarily a line of credit, but some more permanent capital in the form of a debt financing that could work for their business, you know, based on the cash flow that they're generating. The other things that happen are really related to how they think about running their business. So it's not just that they've gotten the 50 million in revenue and now they decide, oh, I really want to raise capital. They may have no intention of raising capital, but as I said, they sort of wake up one day and they realize, well, can I actually maybe get this to 100 million of revenue? And they have that epiphany moment where they're like, well, what got me here isn't going to get me there. I need more advice and talent around me to help guide the ship. When I say strategic finance, it is everything down to the bookkeeping level if it needs to be done, because we offer a bespoke service based on the client situation. But we start out and it has to include the strategic CFO services. And the strategic CFO services are really related to advising the CEO and being their partner in helping to drive the business with all the financial data connected to operations so that they can make the best decisions in driving the business forward.
If you think back of each of those phases of your career, a management consultancy, you know, private equity, and looking for investments, I guess, were you on the search side? Was that it? And then eventually you seem to...
I was originating deals and then sitting on boards and, you know, helping to build the companies and hopefully sell them at a profit.
And if you think of like that phase in your career, what did you learn from that you still use today? Do you think, wow, because if I think back at different phases of my career, there's sometimes I think, well, you know what? From that time, I learned you just got to pick up the phone and talk to people sometimes, or from that career. So what did you learn most from your private equity experience?
I would say in terms of being successful as an entrepreneur and how I can help a business leader kind of grow and expand their business, it's really related to a couple of fundamental things. And they're high-level concepts, but they drive discipline in the whole financial operations connection and the whole finance function, as well as tying into strategy. And those are due diligence readiness. Okay. And that means that you've got a finance operation that really understands the whole business with a lot of analytical detail that is also very much connected to the strategic direction of the company. So at any given moment, you can put together the materials needed to explain the story to a third party in a very clean and efficient way. In order to be able to do that, you have to have a lot of, you know, you don't need to have like supercharged systems in the background. You just need to have a methodical process, clean data, and have gone through the work of understanding how all these things fit together. The second part is a value creation plan. And that's really where you are talking to the executive leadership team. Sometimes it's just the CEO about how are you creating value in this business? Why can you create value in this business? And then what's the strategy going to be behind that so that you can really carry that forward? And those two high-level concepts really help guide a lot of the sausage making in the background, because they're pretty clear litmus tests about how you're going to spend your time in driving the business, especially through finance, right? It says like, hey, I'm going to work on this project, or I've got this priority that I'd like to complete, you know, within the next 9 months. And you can always ask yourself, well, how does that contribute to due diligence readiness? And how does that contribute to the value creation plan? And if you can check those boxes, you can feel pretty good about spending time doing that.
So value creation, you say the words, and I know what value is, and I know what creation is, but together I'm like, what would that instantiate out to? Like, would that be a certain profit margin or an enterprise value?
So the way I think about it is once I'm involved with a business and my team is in there and we analyze, how does this business actually make money? We build a custom financial model that is directly connected to how the chart of accounts works in the accounting system, because we try to keep it as basic as possible at the beginning so that the executive leadership team can really see how the actual numbers relate to the forecasted numbers. But when you build that financial model and you really understand how does this business make money, I sort of think of it as like a layered, an upside down sort of wedding cake, right? What happens is you've got this financial model and you can think of the P&L from top to bottom: revenue, service delivery or cost of product expenses, then operating expenses, then you've got your financing costs and whatever you want to put below the line in terms of like you know, taxes and that kind of stuff. In order to have something left at the bottom of the income statement, right, the top has to be relatively wide in terms of the revenue, right? And each one of those layers has certain metrics that are associated with it. So ultimately, you want to deliver value at the bottom of the income statement. And what we focus on is, okay, at each layer, what are the key KPIs that you need to measure, and at what level do they need to be at so that there's profit at the bottom of the income statement? A good example is always customer acquisition costs, right? And, you know, what is the revenue leverage that you get on your customer acquisition cost? If your lifetime revenue is four times your customer acquisition cost, you've got a pretty great head start to try to trickle that money down to make money at the bottom of the income statement. But if you're at, you know, 2 to 1, then more and more components of the income statement start to matter in order to allow that double on revenue that you're getting on the customer acquisition to trickle through to make profit. And the value creation plan is each one of those components, and knowing what they are, being able to measure them at the best of your ability. And I'm not talking about needing complex systems or anything like that. It can be pretty basic, and it could even be sort of gut instinct at the beginning, but you want to know what they are. And once you know what they are, then you can start to figure out how you're going to measure them.
Okay. Well, let's start at the top with your wedding cake there, you know, with the revenue and customer acquisition costs, because this can be a little intimidating. Even my own business, we roughly know what we're going to pay to acquire a customer. Well, I know we've been profitable at the end. Not always totally clear what the relationship is there. And like you say, determining what you should spend on acquiring a customer is often not obvious, you know, and very difficult to be clear on. So let's talk about operationalizing that. So let's say start at the top, you know, roughly, do you use a benchmark to determine what your payback period should be or what you should be willing to spend to acquire a customer?
Typically what we do is we look at what's happened in the past, and we actually gather the data to actually figure out what is the actual lifetime value of the customer right now. And when you do that, you start to uncover sort of the variance in each component. So your customer acquisition historically over the last 12 months may range from $100 to $400, right? And you want to triage and try to understand, well, when it was $400, why did that happen? When it was $100, why did that happen? And there's a lot of randomness and things that you might not be able to explain, but at least you know what the range is. And then you can start to like zero in on, all right, well, what's kind of a good average that we can target? And then you do the same thing with the size of the client and the amount of revenue. And then that sort of gets you into thinking like, oh, well, when I spent $400, I ended up with clients with, you know, three times as much revenue potential.
Yeah.
Maybe. And then you need to understand the interplay between those two things. But ultimately, you want to kind of get to, at least at the beginning, an average model that you want to try to target. And we're basing that on historical numbers that we will go through the effort of gathering for the client if they don't really understand how to do it. You know, once we do that, we can start putting the model in place. And at that point, we're not even really building the financial model. We're really looking at a unit economic model. We're saying we're just going to look at one customer and flow them through the process and figure out how much money they make at the end.
Okay. So in doing that, like I see, because there's a lot of variability that happens, right? Because I know from our own metrics, it can vary a lot. Like a lifetime customer can go up and down. Like I think there's a formula in SaaS anyway, which is you multiply your churn by your customer amount, and then you apply that to be able to get a lifetime value. But that can vary a lot. But I guess it gives guardrails, like, or at least allows you to put the ladder against the right wall. If you say, if you're going to look at a new marketing channel, roughly what do we think we could acquire a customer in that channel? And if it's just way off, like if it's Super Bowl advertising,
100%,
it's just never going to work, right? So yeah, it needs you to sort of make a better guess.
Yeah, well, take the Super Bowl example, right? So you have, let's say we step into a business and we create this unit economic model, and we say the average customer acquisition cost is $250, right?
Right.
And then the lifetime value is, let's say, $1,500, you know, which would be amazing, right? But then all of a sudden somebody shows up into the meeting and says, "Oh, we should spend $1 million on the Super Bowl ad," right? And you can pretty quickly do the math on that. You know, if you're buying like a, I don't know, even know what a Super Bowl ad costs these days. Let's just say, for argument's sake, it's $1 million. Okay, well, how does that $1 million turn into a $250 acquisition cost? It means that you need to have an astronomical number of leads that come in.
Yeah.
Right. And then then you need to convert those leads so that they average out to $250. And all of a sudden, you know, the math quickly sort of breaks down, right? Depending on what product you're in. So that's like an extreme example, but it helps illustrate how, when you actually know what you're trying to target, you can quickly do the math on some new channel and, you know, come up with a decent estimate of how many leads does that channel need to generate in order for me to actually have enough clients coming into the funnel that if I've got a normal conversion rate, I can kind of convert those customers. And then let's not forget that when you introduce new channels, your conversion rate for those channels is going to be different. Right.
And even when you scale those channels, sometimes, you know, like,
right, exactly. And typically what I find is the deeper you go into a channel, you know, the law of diminishing returns kicks in.
Yeah.
And you may find some pockets of opportunity that improve your performance. But if you really are deep in that channel and you have been for a long time, the deeper you go, the harder it gets, because you generally have figured out the low hanging fruit early on. And then the deeper you go, the harder it gets. So then your costs start going up. Your conversion comes down. You still may be making money, right? You know, in the example that I gave where it's a 250 average and a 1500 lifetime value. Well, if you go deeper and deeper into the channel and you're starting at 250, but you've got another 1250 to chew through. Well, you can go to 500, 750, and your lifetime value is going to come down to, you know, 1250, 1000, 750, and you may be happy with that, you know, level of incremental profit.
Yeah. Well, Kanye, that's the questions, because let's step down the income statement one and go into sales management, because then the sales team, you spent the money getting the lead. Now you might need a sales team to convert, often cases, you know. And you've got a story about a client you worked with that, you know, had an existing sales team, and then suddenly you were able to bring insight into how that team was actually operating.
Yeah. So this was a founder-run business. A lot of people on the sales team had been there for a while. And so, you know, obviously a thing that founders often struggle with is loyalty to, it's a small company, you get to know people pretty intimately in some cases. And so you have certain attachment to people, and I get all that, and that's definitely always got to be factored into kind of how you ultimately execute on big changes. But in this instance, we, you know, was a 40 person sales team. If you looked at the customer acquisition work that they were doing and looked at how much they were being paid, the volume of marketing that they were consuming with their leads, and you basically did an ROI on the salespeople, you would come up with some of these, we're losing money on some of these sales reps, right? And you don't need to actually be that sophisticated in your analysis to kind of do profitability by salespeople. It can be simpler than that. In this instance, what we did was we basically said, let's take all the salespeople, rank them by conversion rate, right?
Right.
And then what I said to them was, okay, now what we're going to do, this was a company that does phone sales. And I said, okay, now let's get some data about, we're going to put these people into a quadrant, right? Four quadrants. I kept it very simple, but it ultimately worked to really identify where it was. I said, the quadrant in the upper right is going to be high conversion and high talk time. So they're, you know, they're working hard because you could see based on the phone data that they're spending time on the phone and they're converting high, those are your winners. Okay. You want to, the strategy for them is you want to retain them and you probably want to give them more leads, right? Then in the next quadrant, you have the people who have high talk time, but suboptimal. Okay. Those people you need to nurture. So we want to hold on to those folks. And you have to have a different strategy, which is continual training. You probably want to spend more time talking to them about their sales strategy. Then you've got it below the winners. You've got the people who have low talk time and high conversion, which is an odd bucket, right?
Yeah.
So I call those guys sort of like the lottery tickets, right? They are basically, for some period of time, they're being lucky. And I said, if you want to keep those people, you can think about keeping them. But what you need to do is you need to ride herd on them and get them to get their talk time up so you can really figure out how lucky they are, right? Is it like pure skill or is it luck? And then in the bottom quadrant, the final quadrant, you had the people who had low talk time and low conversion. And there it's like, there's really no decision to be made here. These people don't really care. They're if you've done it over like say a 90-day, 120-day period, and that's the numbers, you know, the question is like, who's managing them? Why do you want to keep these people around? Or do they what else are they contributing? Because ultimately, as a salesperson, it's all about, you know, conversion and bringing in the sales. So using that simple analysis, we were really able to just communicate with the founders, hey, this is a quadrant that you really have to make some tough decisions on, you know, and it was probably about 20% of the sales floor that fell into that bucket. And the thing is, like, on the conversion rate, as they went through the names, there were a lot of excuses that you could make for each individual. Right.
Well, I'm imagining, I'm saying, well, those guys with the low talk time, they're just, you know, Sal's just great with customers. He knows what to say and he just Jedi mind tricks them into, you know, it's just great.
Yeah.
You know?
And so then you have to go through, that's where you go into more of the subjective and the, you know, kind of the human side of it. Human side of it, meaning like a lot of like the founder's emotional feelings about who's in that bucket. Right.
Right.
And that's where you know, are really like working with the founder to kind of help them develop, you know, more of a view of running the business as an executive. And it's not personal. It's really about trying to run a better business.
So you said there, you went to the founders for this. First of all, how much do you think these founders already knew this? They just needed.
They know who's not performing, but sometimes you have to distill the information in a certain way so that it really kind of resonates. And I think that when they would look at, if they were just looking at their monthly sales performance and they had people sort of at the bottom of the list, they would say, oh, well, that guy, that particular salesperson actually performed well a few months ago. We need to invest in them. You know what I mean? But So as I said, everybody's got a story for why one individual could actually make it. And that's the thinking that they would go through on their own as they were just looking at the results on a monthly basis. But once you package it for them in a very simple way, there's really no escaping, like, you need to make some decisions here, you know? And by the way, it's not just decisions about what are you going to do with the lowest quadrant. It's also highlights the fact that in my winner category, I got to figure out how to make these guys and gals more successful and how do I retain them, right? So now all of a sudden you by juxtaposing the two in a simple way, you all of a sudden realize, wow, I need to invest in these people. And let's not forget that the winners, If you read any range of management books, and this is always true, the winners know who the underperformers are. And the underperformers, depending on the individual, you know, they annoy the winners. The winners want to be around more hardworking winners, yeah. And you're actually doing them a disservice by having underperformers hang around for longer than they should.
Yeah, it's like when I heard a phrase which was A players like to play with other A players, B players like to play with C players, you know, like
right, exactly.
Culture.
Yeah.
I hear of someone, a friend, a business owner, and they lay someone off. We all say to them, oh, well done, you know, it was good. You never regret it. The same things are said all the time. You know, it's never a bad decision. They're always better off. You're always better off. You know, we say these things. And I think it's largely true, but I think having that black and white justification helps people sleep better at night. So, okay, well, it's there in black and white. It's not, you know, Sal doesn't know these people. He was just looking at the numbers. No one can argue with that, you know. And that's good. I mean, I think that's a great advantage as well, to having a fractional CFO come in, because you haven't got that, you know, you've no axe to grind. You've no,
yeah.
This is just the way it is, right? So
yeah. And listen, I'm opening to hearing the individual by individual merits, right? And that is somewhat cathartic, I think, for the founders to actually go through that process. And what I'm there for is to say, okay, well, we understand how you feel about that, but let's talk about what the objective information is. And that, what I always do is I guide them back to what you just said is the A players want to play with A players. And I say to them, you'd like to make an exception for this person, but by making an exception for this person, you're actually diminishing the value of these other people. And how about them? You know, that actually really does resonate with them, because they realize like, oh, wow, that's if I was in that situation and I was working and I was performing, I would want to be around performers. And so it starts to color their view in a different way, you know.
And this, I mean, especially in this day and age where there's a global economy and oftentimes you're dealing with people at different pay scales and so on, like there can be a big difference in terms of actual productivity, whether it be sales, engineering, success, anything. And sometimes putting these lenses on, it's almost like you get to see things in a new perspective. It can radically change your perspective on that. Okay, cool. So listen, let's go a step. Well, I like this approach you've introduced here. I like this wedding cake. So let's keep going with it. So let's take another slice further down in terms of operations. And I'm always interested in this sort of finance operations, sort of air gap, if you like. When it comes to controlling, we get into operations and costs, let's just say overhead. Like, what's your go-to move for looking at a business? So you got a good business, got a good, you know, lifetime value versus cost of acquiring a customer, sales team, we sorted that out. And then you get, maybe it's a bit tighter. What's your approach looking at operational spend and overhead and controlling those costs at that layer of the business?
That's always a bit trickier. My sense is always been that on the OPEX side, if you're doing really good on producing the customers and you've got, then the next thing you want to do is focus on retention. So I feel like anything that is enhancing the experience of the client from an OPEX standpoint, I would like to prioritize that. And I'm speaking from a situation, let's just say I'm going into a situation where all of this is relatively new. It's all new thinking within the organization and I'm introducing all these concepts.
Sure.
I always want to focus on first, from an OPEX standpoint, what are you doing to retain and manage the customers? Let's prioritize that. And then there's two sort of rules of thumb that I kind of play by. One is, if you want to get into a discussion about customer retention that involves some gigantic IT project,
right?
From a finance standpoint, obviously we want to look at the ROI and try to evaluate that. But this is a little bit more of how I play in the on the operations side. What I really try to focus the teams on, especially in these smaller companies where, you know, they don't have as much infrastructure, is let's break down this large IT concept that you have, and can we distill it down into versions of success that are much quicker in their success, and you can measure them much more quickly, as opposed to I'll give you an example on the finance side. I'm gonna, for whatever reason, I feel like someone told me I need to upgrade to NetSuite, right? And I'm on QuickBooks, and that there's a huge chasm you have to cross to be able to do that. And if you want to do the NetSuite upgrade, that's all well and good. But is there a way for us to do it in a way where we can achieve certain wins relatively quickly, and we're not delaying the overall achievement of the implementation for every single bell and whistle that you're looking for, right? You got to like put it into slices of success that you can gain over time. So that's what I tend to do on those types of projects. And they, when you're talking about customer retention, generally there's a lot of technology that's involved in that. And so I try to keep people focused on what I call quick wins. And let's use quick wins to build up to the giant success that you're going to have later on. And then my second rule of thumb is when you get below that level, my sense is I've never really seen a business get hurt in the short to medium term by delaying OpEx.
What do you mean by that?
So that means like, you know, a bunch of people get into a room, they come up with this OpEx plan, and now all of a sudden they want to spend $1 million, $2 million more in the next budget cycle because they need these operating expenses or this additional headcount. And what I always try to remind people is like, well, it's great that you want to do that, but what's really interesting is that you've gotten this far without it.
Right.
So how soon do you really need that based on the amount of customers that are coming in and sort of the bread and butter of the business? And then it forces them to really justify the significant changes that are going to happen in the business that require that OpEx to be pulled forward.
So give me a specific example of something you've seen where, you know, the success team or...
The business is successful. There's this natural human tendency to like, I'd like to have a bigger team and a bigger budget, right?
Sure.
And so I'll take, you know, like say an HR department wants to have a learning and development function, right? And it's kind of like, let's say in the instance of this company, well, your client retention is pretty good. Your marketing is pretty good.
Yeah.
What's different about learning development from yesterday versus what learning development is going to look like when you bring in this learning and development team of like three people? Like what's going to change?
Yeah.
How is that going to actually drive training to a level where your retention rates get better or your customer acquisition gets better? How do you justify that sort of investment? And my view is like, you probably can push something like that out, you know, almost indefinitely until you actually realize that you've got a certain level of pain, and then you can kind of implement it. But if you're not feeling pain, generally these things can be sort of justified as nice to have, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the one I think of then from our business is we have people all over the world. And we never had actually an all hands on site anywhere. You know, it's almost been one of these things where it's like, it seems, I don't want to say a luxury, but like, it's quite expensive to do. And it's very expensive, in fact. And it's always a thing we said, yeah, that would be good. But then when you look at it, you go, well, what's going to get better? It's going to take people out of the office for a week. You know, it's going to be all these things. And you're going to like, and then you start to look at, well, does that line up with how we're doing in terms of our metrics? Maybe we can justify it and say, okay, let's say, guys, we get to this customer number, you know, this retention rate, whatever you're looking for, or maybe you tie it to something, and then maybe there's kind of an attaboy element to it. But of course, people, especially in operations, and this is the big challenge. Like, yeah, it's all very easy to talk about things like engineering and sales and things that are all very track and, you know, you can put a number to. A lot of businesses just aren't at the scale where you're able to measure in that way, especially when it comes to customer satisfaction. You can do all the NPS in the world. That NPS doesn't always tie up to retention levels. So what are you going to do? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in engineering is another good example where that is, I think, easier to, you can feel pain right away, right? You know what your effective utilization is generally on your engineering team, and you know how much time they're putting in. And then you've got this roadmap that says, I need these five new features, or I'm going into this new market segment, and I need to have a new version of my product that addresses that market segment, right?
Right.
In that instance, you can kind of look at your engineering team and say, there's just not enough man hours in the day to be able to execute on that. Therefore, we need to increase our engineering hiring, and those people need to be sort of dedicated to that assignment of that aspect of the roadmap. That kind of stuff is an easier thing to assess and make a decision on in OpEx. But there are many things that don't fit in with the quick wins rule of thumb and the I can push this off indefinitely and I'm probably not going to be any better or worse off without it. You know, someone in the room, like the pessimist in the room, can just say, well, if you never did this ever, what do you think would happen? You know, I know on the engineering side, if you've got this product roadmap, you say, well, we'll never implement this product and we'll never be able to enter this new market segment. Well, that's a problem, right? You can, you know, going back to what I said earlier in the conversation, the value creation plan. Yeah. Well, that's aligned with my value creation plan. You know, if I take the learning and development one and I say to myself, if I push this off indefinitely, what's going to happen? And you might say to yourself, probably nothing. And then you say, well, how does that fit into my value creation plan? I'm not really sure what it does for my value creation plan, right?
Okay. All right. Well, listen, I'd like to wrap things up by speaking a little bit about your own success in building your firm. And you've just tell us a bit about, you know, what you've managed to do in the early, I think, of your business, and what makes you being able to create a business to scale to the level that you have versus someone else who might be doing this 3 or 4 years and not have the level that you've managed to achieve.
Yeah. So, you know, I have been fortunate enough to have built up a good professional network of relationships that have a lot of access to entrepreneur-owned businesses, you know, also, you know, obviously venture capitalists, et cetera. Although, as I said, most of my clients are founder-owned. You know, in fact, you know, if you really took a number to it on a dollar level, it's probably like 95% are founder-owned in terms of the fees that I'm getting. But they've got these connections into these executives and entrepreneurs who are in this situation. And my first degree connections, you know, made some introductions or were actually those people. And when I told them what I was doing, they were like, we really need to talk because I've been thinking about this and I just never acted on it. And all of a sudden I'm presenting them with something that's kind of on their front door and they're like, this is great. But what I would say is, in terms of like building that network, the reason that I have those relationships is, I think a key thing is, when I'm in conversations with people about their business issues, regardless of whether I'm vested in it or not, I sort of always adopt an approach with people that I'm going to give them like my best, honest advice in whatever context we're in. And I may never have met you before. I may not even know who you are. But the minute you start talking about what's going on in your business, you have some curiosity about what I do, I'm going to start asking you questions and giving you some point of view that hopefully is something you haven't heard before. And I don't go into the conversation thinking I'm going to do that. I just have this natural tendency to do that. And from a networking standpoint, just in cold meetings, that giving of information is something that people tend to remember and attach to. And so I've done that over my career pretty much always. And so I think then when I suddenly appear with this product and I'm just talking to people or I'm just going through my LinkedIn network, I think I've got a little bit of people sort of remembering me for giving them some small, smart contribution that they may have done nothing with, but at least they felt like it was worth hearing about.
Well, that's a real skill, right? Because there's got to be there's an art and a science there to being a know-it-all in someone's business. They've worked all their year and being able to say something smart. So that's a real skill. And what your story there is reminding me of my experience recently of I've dealt with a marketing company who has been looking for our business, and we've had meeting after meeting, and it hasn't been that they've been said anything wrong, but it's been kind of, the typical sales situation where you're giving them all the information they're discovering, And then I had another meeting recently, literally 15 minutes with someone who obviously knew what they were talking about. And they had three solid ideas for me in 15 minutes time. And gave me a price at the end of it. I'm like, well, she's went, straight ahead. She demonstrated her value in 15 minutes. What taking the other guys weeks and weeks, and they haven't got there yet. So, and I think that comes from having obviously the expertise. Typically in a normal sales situation, you're always taught to gather requirements, figure out what the clients want. It's all kind of one way. But if you flip the script on that and are just able to save everyone a lot more time, if you're able to demonstrate quickly, okay, listen, I obviously know what I'm talking about here. And that's kind of screens out everyone who shouldn't be interested.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of that, but you do need to be a good listener and just know that you don't know everything.
Sure.
And so I think if you go in thinking you know everything, I think the person on the other side of it is going to come away with thinking like, this person didn't really listen to what I have to say. And that's a problem for just sort of the ongoing relationship.
Yeah.
Like for me, it's maybe not earth-shattering insights, but they're maybe even just thinking about it as like you're asking really smart questions and then flipping that into like, well, did you, based on the answer that they give you, you can either ask a follow-up question or have an idea of, hey, did you ever try this? Or I've seen this. A lot of things that are helpful to people are, what do you have in your background that's similar to what they're experiencing? And give them an example of how that actually played out so that they get like some good knowledge of an anecdotal situation that was similar to theirs. That's always very helpful too. And obviously that comes with, having been around a lot of situations and looking at a lot of different businesses, you over the years, the older you are, you just gather these right. situations that you've seen, and you can kind of relay them to somebody else in a way that helps them pull a few things out of it that might be useful to them.
Very good, yeah.
I think the other thing that I do is I do attend networking events, typically like law firms that are having networking events where they're pitching something related to entrepreneurship. Like I went to one recently where they were talking about raising what's called venture debt, which right. venture debt is a form of debt that applies to venture-backed companies. And so obviously that audience was full of, some venture capitalists, but also entrepreneurs who, wanted to hear about what was happening in the market, and it gives you a good opportunity to just network with people who are.
So venture debt is where, you'll raise some debt along with some investment, equity investment.
Correct. And
venture debt is kind of using the equity investment to sort of vet the prospect for them.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The venture lender takes, it's a secured loan, and they're generally funding into deals where they know the venture capital investors. So they typically tend to try to follow the smart money around.
Right.
And then they basically give you a loan that you would never be able to get otherwise, because they specialize in this kind of debt. And it comes with some warrants, so they get some equity upside. And they're basically making, an outsized return, not necessarily on the interest that they're charging you, but on the fact that they're building this portfolio of warrants in a bunch of different companies. It's like their own little mini venture capital portfolio. And when they get a couple of winners, three, four winners out of 100 in there, it supercharges their return, because those opportunities will be so outsized that right. it'll make up for all the warrants that are worthless. And their loan portfolio, I think, is relatively stable,
Right.
It's they're not taking big losses in that portfolio.
Yeah, interesting approach. Because I guess you're right, they're getting the upside, but they don't have to do all the due diligence. I guess they just have to vet the venture firms that they're working with.
They really rely on the on the quality of work that the venture capital investors do. And, you know, obviously they're evaluating the management team and looking at the numbers and that kind of stuff. But
Very good. I like that tip. It's good. Like law firms, you think about it, they're also at the right end of the gene pool, let's say, in terms of these companies have some sort of traction. Law firms don't generally, don't known for their philanthropy. So they will be dealing with people who are in real business per se.
Yeah. And they get to know their clients pretty well, right? And so they're, you know, typically in that line of work, they're also very business oriented, right? These are, you know, they're writing contracts, looking at investment opportunities. And, you know, as they get to know their clients, they can kind of, and they, if they know there's a CFO services firm out there that they're familiar with, they often say, hey, I need to make you should at least talk to Sal, because right. I think he might be able to help you with some of this stuff. And, you know, and it's got these are the merits of it, you know, and then that's a good warm intro.
Well, if anyone having listened to this wants to talk to Sal, what should they do?
You can find me on LinkedIn, Salvatore Tirabassi.
Cool.
I'm the only one on there.
And okay, then, awesome.
You could also just, if you go to my website, cfoproanalytics.com, there's a button there where you could just schedule a quick call with me if you want to have a quick chat.
Great. And to finish up, I always ask people here, do you have a business hero and why?
Yeah, you know, I could pick from a few different names. I would say my business hero that I would mention here is Jamie Dimon, who's the chairman and CEO of Chase. From a business standpoint, he's, you know, just running a sprawling financial enterprise that has managed to weather a number of storms and really has provided kind of a lifeline to, you know, other companies, and also just generally being at the forefront of stability in the financial markets. I don't know that that's necessarily what I find most impressive about him. I think that just to be able to manage a business like that at that size, maintain a culture of success is extremely difficult to do. And I know, just a quick anecdote, I did a lot of banking with First Republic over the years, which people who are listening to this would know that that was one of the smaller banks that got caught upside down on the treasury yield trade, and they ended up, you know, having a liquidity crisis, and Chase had to buy them. Chase came in as the buyer. I know some pretty senior level people that work there, and they had just amazing things to say about the operation of Chase and the quality of the people that they were dealing with. That to me, that I was like, yeah, you know, it kind of seems like it's a really well-run organization just based on the services that I use at Chase. And then the other thing is, like, you know, Jamie Dimon is on CNBC occasionally being interviewed, and he does sort of like these tour of America interviews, and he's an extremely personable and highly intelligent guy who knows about a lot of things. So he's just really interesting to listen to. You know, and he's got a very sort of graceful way of talking about, like, very serious issues that, you know, is a really good quality for people to have. There should be more people who are, you know, talking to the media and are able to kind of discuss issues that are highly charged in a very intelligent and graceful way, as opposed to, you know, firing up the masses on either side of the topic.
Right. Well, we know what that's like these days.
Yeah.
It's interesting you should say that, because it's the second time he's come up here. And I see that's often like a skill of a successful fractional CFO, is to be able to talk about these sometimes emotive topics. Some of them we talked about today, you know, involving headcount and other things, but just put it in a very almost diplomatic way, like have a way of displaying but it is, no more, no less, is a skill and a key skill for a successful CFO.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. All right. Great. Thanks, Sal. And thank you for listening so far to the Gross Profit Podcast. Your special reward for getting this deep into the podcast is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/partners. There I've got a webinar which actually relates directly to what Sal has been talking about here, which is how to deliver value fast when you're going into a new organization in a finance role. What you don't want to do, it's actually like we discussed today, is go in and recommend a 12-month, 18-month ERP implementation when actually all you need to do is control costs fast. And we can be part of the story there. I've got a great case study with Ben de la Cretas. He works with TechCXO. And we are part of the toolkit that he uses to get costs under control fast. We talked about that messy part under the operations OPEX spend that's sometimes hard to get your arms around. And we can definitely help with that. And you can learn about how Ben does that with his clients. So that's at procurementexpress.com/partners. Sal, it's been a lot of fun. You've really demonstrated your expertise in this. I think you're a very good communicator in the way you've been able to explain, you know, the value you can bring up to different layers of the IS. And thanks very much for coming on today.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.